From London, it's the Wired.co.uk podcast. It is episode 12 for February the 11th, 2011. In the news this week...
Prove the scientific studies are wrong. Win back your reputation, and while you're at it, win $1 million for you or the charity of your choice. Come on, prove us wrong.
Renowned skeptic James Randi has offered $1 million to the manufacturers of homeopathic remedies to prove the claims they make about their products. So we speak to Dr. Ben Goldacre, a medical doctor and author of the book and Guardian column Bad Science, about the facts behind homeopathy. But first, it's the week in Wired News. Hi there, I'm Nate Langson and I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk, and within the Wired two-man tent this week are just two men. And in fact, one of them's actually not a man. It's our news editor, Olivia Solon.
Hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm good, thank you.
Good. We are sans Duncan today because he's over in San Francisco playing with new HP products, which we're going to talk about in a bit. But first, I want to talk about a very interesting piece we've got on the site this week, which is basically robot wars, only instead of robots, it's white blood cells. Liv, what the hell?
This is a really cool art science installation that's currently in Dublin Science Gallery. The whole exhibition is called Visceral, and it kind of marries lots of different artists and science, mainly kind of living systems. Now, this Blood Wars piece sees the artist, who's called Kathy High, take blood samples from two different people, extract the white blood cells, and then place them together in a Petri dish and observe them and film them under a microscope and see which one comes off best. And then the winning white blood cells or winning immune system goes on to compete against a series of other white blood cells.
And the footage is basically taken as a time lapse and then sped up. So the idea is that you can watch the white blood cells
exactly
sort of fighting each other.
Exactly.
This will never be on the BBC, by the way. It's a real shame, maybe.
Yeah, but there's loads of other really, really interesting exhibits there as well. I mean, one of my favourite ones is actually called Host. And it's meant to be giving people the perspective of an insect. And there's lots and lots of tiny little tubs with little crickets contained on these little sticks facing towards a big screen. And on the screen is this kind of insect view image of a guy giving a lecture on sex life, the sex life of insects.
That's bizarre.
Yeah, very bizarre. And then they're feeding in, translating that lecture into kind of cricket speak by using like high vibration oscillations, which is how they hear, and then feeding it back into the crickets and vice versa. It's very, very cool.
That's crazy. But tell me about the semi-living worry dolls.
Yeah, this is, again, really, really weird. It's these kind of tissue-engineered sculptures which were inspired by Guatemalan worry dolls that are given to kids to, you know, tell their worries to. But you would not want to tell your worries to these. These are little, like, fake flesh that they've been created. It's been actually created by... out of degradable polymers, but then seeded with living cells that then grow to replace the original polymers. And they're in a kind of little micro gravity bioreactor. But pretty gross. You wouldn't want to be cuddling up to these at night.
Are you kidding?
What?
I totally would.
That's what? A little kind of fake, fleshy creature in a test tube.
Cuddle might be a strong word. It might be more of I'll put them on a shelf and have them as a talking point when people come round.
Yeah, but you won't be whispering. I reckon they'd stink a little bit.
They would. Well, we've got a great little, I say it's not little, it's massive photo story on the site at the moment. If you do a search for Blood Wars in the handy little search bar, you will find this. And I do encourage it because it's pretty crazy. Not crazy, though, is that... in San Francisco this week, HP has announced not only the new Palm Pre, which is its main smartphone, but also the touchpad. So Duncan is over there in San Francisco at the moment. He's been playing with all these devices, and I wasn't going to let him get away with not being on the podcast at all this week. So I got him to get up at 5 a.m. and talk to me on Skype. So let's hear what he had to say. Duncan.
Hi.
How's San Francisco?
It's lovely. It's very nice and warm.
Good. Well, we miss you very much here back in London. Okay, no comment. Fine. Okay. So you've been over with HP playing with the new touchpad and Pre 3 and Veer. Let's start with the touchpad. Is it any good?
Yeah, surprisingly so. I was kind of coming out and I was expecting to be not disappointed, but I was expecting it to just be another tablet. And I've actually been a little bit impressed by it.
Really? I mean, it's basically, I mean, is it kind of just the WebOS made into a tablet?
Yes, but there's more to that than it suggests. WebOS has always been a very, it's always had a really lovely user experience, the whole swooshing things around and gestures and all of that. And on a phone, it can be a little bit tricky to, on a tiny screen, do all of those things. But when you expand the screen size to tablet, then it's actually really, really nice. It's spacious, it's easy to use, it's really pleasant.
I have to say, I'm not entirely surprised. It always felt a little bit like the Pre was designed to be on a tablet and was kind of restricted by being on the small form factor of the you know, the original Pre phones.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. And it's kind of funny that they've launched the touchpad at the same time as they've launched an absolutely minuscule device, the Veer, which is has got a tiny, tiny little screen.
It reminds me actually a little bit of the Kin, the Microsoft Kin, the ill-fated Kin, in fact.
The ill-fated Kin, yeah. It's I think there's a lot of similarities between the two. I kind of hope that the Veer does a little bit better because I like the idea of, you know, tiny screen devices. Like the, is it the Nano, the most recent iPod Nano?
Yeah, it's kind of a square, like a big shuffle with a screen.
Yeah, a little bit like that. And obviously it's slightly bigger than the Nano is, but it's I like the idea of designing for much, much smaller screens.
So let's just go back to the touchpad briefly. I guess the question that everyone is probably going to want to know is it better than the iPad? And if
no.
not, why not?
I mean, it's obviously it's come out a year, almost a year after the iPad, and we're due iPad 2 any minute now. And that's significant because although it does push out a little bit in front of the iPad in some ways, it's also probably going to be knocked straight back down again when the iPad 2 comes out.
But it's got some pretty amazing specs. You know, I mean, on paper, it looks like a great bit of kit. But you were saying that one of the limitations is probably going to be the App Store. That's just not up to snuff compared with Android or iPad, of course.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, obviously, Android and iOS have hundreds of thousands of apps to choose from, a ludicrous amount. And whereas the app catalog is only at, like a couple of thousand, something like that. So there's a lot less choice when it comes to that. And what's going to be key for HP and Palm is trying to persuade people that maybe apps aren't that important after all. And there are certainly people out there who, you know, who buy an iPad and just don't really download any apps at all. I can't remember what the figure is. There's a percentage that has been worked out of people who just don't download any apps after they've bought an iPad. And perhaps those users might be persuaded that the touchpad is the way to go.
Based on what you've seen, what do you think is sort of the number one selling point? Like, why would somebody want to go out and really research the touchpad over, say, the iPad, or as well as the iPad?
Well, the really, really cool thing that it does only actually works if you own a Pre 3 as well, which is the most recent version of the Palm Pre, or the HP Pre, I should say now. What happens is they can connect in two different ways. They can connect over Bluetooth, but also in proximity using the Touchstone charging, wireless charging technology. You can tap your Pre 3 onto your touchpad, and it will then load up whatever app or web page you were on the tablet on your Pre 3. So if you're just, I don't know, you're at home, you're looking on your tablet and you need to go out. And so you find your, I don't know, the map to the restaurant or something like that. You can just tap your phone on your touchpad and it beams it straight over, opens up on the Pre 3 and you can just go. And that's really nifty.
But possibly not enough to get someone away from the sort of the Apple universe that's been established for a lot longer in terms of
possibly
tablets.
Not. No. I mean, it's a nice little feature. And there's another quite cool feature. They sort of hook up via Bluetooth as well. And so if you're on your sofa with your touchpad and you've got your Pre 3 across the room and it suddenly rings or it gets a text message, you can actually answer those things on your touchpad.
Ah, now that's something that the iPad has never been able to do, which is, you know, basically, well, I'd say the iPad, it's more of a complaint with iTunes that you've never been able to send text messages and things through your iPhone via your Mac or your PC, which Nokia has been doing for, you know, years, 10 years or more, for example.
Yeah, it's a really, really nice feature. And I'd love to see it on the iPad and iPhone or on Android devices. I think that would be a really cool thing.
Well, just very briefly then, the Pre 3 is the new version of the Pre, which, of course, was originally, when it first came out, the Prix was supposed to be the the savior of Palm, and whereas when HP bought them, bought Palm, it was kind of like they're buying them for the IP, the and WebOS. The Prix 3, then, do you think it's, is it a decent phone, and is it better than the Prix that have been out to date?
It seems to be pretty good. It's definitely better than the Prix to date. There's a lot more power underneath it. It's got a 1.4 gigahertz chip, which is very, very powerful, and it puts it amongst the most powerful smartphones around right now. The Prix 3 is nice. It's good. It's surprisingly business focused. But if you want a user interface that's really nice and swooshy and beautiful, and a QWERTY keyboard as well, then it's possibly the only option. I've never been convinced by the BlackBerry user interfaces. But it comes down to the apps question. If it bothers you that you've only got a handful of apps to choose from, and sure, you've got your Twitter app and your Facebook app, but there isn't much beyond that, not loads in the way of games. If you're fine with that, then yeah, it's a really solid phone.
And lastly, there seemed to be a lot of excitement that these announcements really put HP, Palm, or whatever you want to call them, back in the game. And these are solid competitors to what's been going on with Android and iPad. Is that the feeling you got as well? Was this a really solid announcement?
It's definitely a good move. And I think, to be absolutely fair on HP Palm, it's probably as good a move as they are going to be able to get without suddenly inventing 100,000 apps to arrive on the App Store.
Well, thank you, Duncan. Hopefully he went back to bed. Anyway, on the topic of apps, though, something a bit weird. There is an iPhone app and an iPad app, in fact, that has recently been given the blessing of the Catholic Church. It's called Confession. It's a £1.19 download, and the idea is that it takes you through a mock confessional to prepare you for your big sin dump, if you like.
It reminds me a little bit like the form that you fill in when you're going through US immigration, where it asks you whether you've committed genocide or, you know, whether you've been associated with the Nazi rule. I don't know.
You're forgetting, though, about the fact that the guys there, they aren't all knowing.
That's true. That is true.
You know, that's the big difference between customs officials and almighty beings.
Yeah, but it's not about just knowing what your sins are. It's about communicating your sins to, presumably, they have to then communicate them to an official Catholic priest.
Well, correct? The idea, yeah, is that you can take this app on your phone into the confession booth and it will help you go through the process of confessing.
You can't actually confess through it. It's more of a kind of sin management device whereby you can keep a tally of all the things that you've done wrong.
It leads you through a mock confessional.
Yeah.
So, you know, you can confess, but then you still have to go through the main confession.
Yeah.
It's like telling your best friend all the things you've done wrong, but then you still have to go and tell your parents.
Yeah, I mean, the people who create this app have some serious data on their hands. I think that would be really, really interesting if they could release that, but I'd imagine that would be fairly confidential.
Yeah, the data protection on this, if you say, yes, I have killed someone, and then you send that off to a priest via the internet. I don't know. It's not great. It's a bit annoying because I had this idea ages ago and I called it Pope Idol. And the idea is that, you could do all this via email and you would send in your sins and then you get an email saying, congratulations, you have been forgiven. And then all the sins get published anonymously on a website for people to have a read through. Not exactly the same, I admit. And it certainly wouldn't get approval from the Catholic Church. But it does open the idea of, you know, getting like achievements, you know, 10 sins confessed in 5 minutes or something.
Yeah, I don't see why not. I mean, there's another service I've read about recently, which is where you pay a subscription and then some computer somewhere in the world reads out prayers on your behalf. And I'm not sure that's really the point. I don't know if you can offset your sin by paying money to something that then delivers your prayers.
Yeah, it's not a carbon offset.
Yeah, exactly.
It seems remarkably easy to confess. I don't want to be too much of a skeptic. No, wait, I do. I think it's remarkably easy. Anyway, in other news, academics have claimed that reburial legislation in the UK is stifling archaeology. Liv, tell me about this.
Right, yes. So this relates to a couple of letters that archaeologists have written, which is expressing concern about some legislation relating to reburial of human remains. So the Burial Act that they're referring to was made in 1857. But there's been some amendments made in 2008, which have changed the conditions which seek to enforce the reburial of human remains discovered in England and Wales 2 years after after they've been excavated. Now, for archaeologists, this is a bit of a problem because they need a lot of time to examine remains. And also, you know, once they've if they've got remains of particular cultural or historical significance, they want to put them in museums, or they might develop a new technology that they can use to examine it, you know, many years down the line and find out more insights from our past. So this, at the time that these changes were made to the law, they were promised, archaeologists were promised that that there would be amendments made to factor in their work. And as so far, these haven't been done. So they've been writing these letters to the Justice Secretary, Ken Clark, to ask that he makes these changes. And you know, the problem is that they affect quite a few really interesting dig sites in the UK, including Stonehenge and Happisburg in Norfolk.
So Diane Friendship Taylor, chair of Rescue, the British Archaeological Trust, said in a letter last month that if steps are not taken to rectify the situation, we shall see a significant reduction in the scope and scale of archaeological and historical research. A field in which Britain is an acknowledged world leader.
Yeah. Hopefully they'll get this the new amendment made to this act soon, because otherwise we'll soon see the disappearance of historical human remains from museums.
Big shame.
Big shame.
Here's the truth about the bad ideas homeopathy is based on. The first idea is that illness can be treated by a substance that actually causes the symptoms you want to get rid of. So, to treat fevers, for example, they often use cayenne pepper, since that can produce a sweat. The second idea is that diluting a substance, making it weaker, makes it more effective.
James Randi, who some people may know as being the renowned skeptic who offers huge sums of money, $1 million, to people who can prove pseudoscientific claims as being factual, things like psychics, spoonbenders, things like that. And this week, I mean, he's always been very critical of homeopathic remedies, but this week has offered $1 million to medical institutions that can prove the claims they make behind their homeopathic remedies. Obviously, this isn't the first time, but I thought it was pretty interesting. So I spoke to Dr. Ben Goldacre, who many people listening may know from his book, Bad Science, basically to get behind the myths of homeopathy and find out what's real and what isn't. So I'm here with Dr. Ben Goldacre, the author of Bad Science and columnist for The Guardian. Ben, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, hi, thanks.
So homeopathy is based on these hugely diluted ingredients. Just how diluted are we talking?
So diluted that there are no molecules left of the original ingredient. So you dilute it by 1 in 100. And then you take a drop of that and you dilute that by 1 in 100. And then you take a drop of that and dilute that by 1 in 100. And so what you end up with in a typical homeopathic preparation is a solution that is one part of the original compound per million, 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 million parts of water. And that's roughly the same as one molecule of the original substance in a sphere of water whose diameter is roughly the same as the distance from where we are right now in London to the edge of the sun. So that's an extremely dilute compound. And obviously they came up with this before Avogadro's number, before anybody knew how big the universe was, how many molecules or atoms there are in the universe and so on. So it's a ridiculously dilute solution.
And so
I think that's not the most... Well, sorry, carry on.
Well, no, I was going to move on and ask what kind of a medical model would a homeopath have to create in order to prove the validity of the homeopathic theory?
Well, so, I mean, actually, I think it's really important to recognise that it doesn't matter if you don't know how something works. That's not actually the most important thing about homeopathy not working. So, for example, we don't know how anaesthetics work, but we know that they work because... I mean, I myself have, you know, I've put my hands inside somebody's abdomen after they've been treated with anaesthetics that have completely knocked them out, and they haven't woken up, they've been fine. And we don't know how anaesthetics work. So it's one thing to know how something works. But it doesn't actually matter if you know that it works. And with homeopathy, we know that it doesn't work. So it's very easy to do a trial to see if something works or not. You can do it for any intervention, whether it's a pill or a talking treatment, a psychotherapy, a behavioural intervention, advice to get more exercise, a leaflet, a teaching programme in schools. You can do a randomised trial on absolutely anything where half of the people get one intervention and half the people get another intervention. And people have done this dozens and dozens and dozens of times with homeopathic treatments. And overall, what you find is the people getting the homeopathy treatments don't do any better than the people who are just getting dummy pills that look like homeopathy pills, but haven't been prepared by the kind of fairly magical homeopathic rituals, if you like. And what that tells you is that all of the benefits that people experience from having treatment from a homeopath or from buying a homeopathic pill in a shop or anything like that, all of the benefit that they get is entirely down to the placebo effect, which is, again, you know, a very well-described phenomenon in medicine.
Could you demonstrate the effectiveness or lack thereof of homeopathy by treating animals with the same medication?
If you condition dogs to associate an immune suppressor compound with a particular flavour of water, then you see some of the same changes in their blood markers of the activity of their immune system changing when they just get the flavoured water without the immune suppressor compound in it. There's a huge literature on the placebo effect in animals, and there's also a huge literature on the placebo effect in children. So, I mean, it's a line that's routinely trotted out by homeopaths that the placebo effect cannot possibly work on children and animals, but actually it does, and it's very, very well documented. And I think that's to be expected, because the placebo effect is all about manipulating your beliefs and expectations of a treatment. And children and animals have beliefs and expectations that can be manipulated. You keep a pet because you can have a relationship with it, because it responds to your mood, because it responds to your attention and affection. And children as well, of course, you know, respond to their parents' expectations and mood and concerns and anxieties, but also those anxieties and concerns being allayed. So, you know, there's a very good literature on the placebo effect affecting both children and animals.
Do you think there needs to be stricter regulations on the labelling on homeopathic remedies?
Yeah, I mean, so I've got some quite unusual views generally on this, I think, because I'm quite libertarian when it comes to medicine and also bullshit. I think people should certainly be, you know, allowed to sell homeopathy sugar pills. I don't want to shut anyone down. I do think that you need to label bullshit clearly. And because of that, I think... So I also have different expectations of different agents in this situation. Like, I'm not surprised that homeopaths want to mislead their patients or customers, if you like, about whether their pills work or not. And I'm not surprised that the manufacturers of homeopathy pills want to mislead their customers about whether these pills work or not. But I think there's a real problem when you get to the Medicines and Healthcare Regulatory Authority, because you want your healthcare regulator to be whiter than white, to absolutely follow the evidence. And you want your healthcare regulator's approved labels to say absolutely only what is supported by the evidence. And unfortunately, with the MHRA in the UK, we've seen them overstretching that. And it's a very clear example of political interference. It's political interference changing the activities of a medicines regulator. And I think that's kind of more important for what it tells you about the way that medicines regulation works than I think it's important because of homeopathy. Like, I actually don't find homeopathy very sort of interesting or worrying. To me, it's an interesting teaching tool for evidence-based medicine. It's an opportunity to demonstrate to people how evidence-based medicine works, what constitutes a fair test in a trial that's not subject to biases, that's not subject to kind of flawed design that would cause a trials have a spurious false positive result. I think homeopathy is a brilliant teaching tool for all of that, because after all, the fact that sometimes people come away with the impression that homeopathy sugar pills work as a result of either experiencing the placebo effect themselves, or perhaps having somebody cherry pick the literature for them and only show them the positive results, or only show them positive results that come from flawed trials. That's the sort of thing that happens throughout the whole of the medical literature. And so it's a good teaching tool for explaining the principles of medical research, of randomized trials and systematic reviews. But I think it's also a good tool for looking at how regulation of medicines works, because if you find that your government medicines regulator is allowing people to make claims about what their treatment can treat without evidence because of political pressure, I think, again, that tells you actually quite a worrying story about the way that that medicines regulator operates on the much more complex issues around the pharmaceutical industry. And that's what I spend most of my time writing about in the book, is distortions of medicine by, you know, big pharma and governments and stuff like that, rather than quacks. And that's kind of, that's what I'm doing my next book on at the moment, is distortion of evidence by big pharma and the failure to regulate that adequately. And everything that you see around the dodgy behavior of governments and regulators and individual companies and individual practitioners around very obviously quack medicines like homeopathy, you can see in a slightly more complex form around pharmaceutical drugs.
So if a GP suggested that a patient maybe use a homeopathic remedy, what would a smart medical consumer say or ask in response?
I think they would maybe ask, where is the evidence? I mean, I think doctors are in quite an unusual position when it comes to handing out homeopathy sugar pills, which have been shown in all of the best evidence to perform no better than placebo. Because I think doctors have an obligation to practice evidence-based medicine wherever possible, and there are shortcomings of that in all fields of medicine with all treatments, but wherever possible to follow the evidence, and also to be honest with their patients. And in the popularity of alternative therapies like homeopathy or the kind of vitamin pill salespeople, I think what you see is kind of an old-fashioned, quite outmoded form of medical paternalism, the sort of thing that actually doctors in mainstream medicine left behind a long time ago, which is to say, you've got people using kind of white lies to reassure patients. You've got practitioners saying, well, I know what's wrong with you, perhaps giving a willfully obscurantist, very highly technical explanation of their problems that doesn't really make any sense, but uses a lot of technical language in order to maintain a power relationship in the way that you do with sort of alternative therapists talking about energy patterns or you know, distorted flows of energy or any of the stuff around sort of vitamin pill, sort of vitamin imbalances that you get from nutritionists, that's all sort of basically bogus. And you also get practitioners giving false reassurance by overstating the benefits of treatments. In medicine, about kind of 30 years ago, I suppose, we collectively decided that respecting patients' autonomy and getting informed consent was more important implicitly than even how effective the treatments were. We decided that being honest with patients, telling them about the benefits and disadvantages of a treatment was kind of more important than just saying, take this pill and I promise you'll get better. And I think a GP who takes the backward step of handing out a placebo to a patient is either maybe not incompetent, but certainly it's problematic if a GP is handing over a homeopathy pill without knowing the evidence, because the evidence shows that they're no better than placebo, or that GP is deliberately misleading a patient. And I think ethically, that's certainly quite problematic. And it's problematic enough that I think it deserves, frankly, you know, some serious thought in ethics journals and in sort of regulatory discourse. You know, I think if you're going to say it's all right for doctors to hand out placebo sugar pills to their patients, then you have to sort of rethink the whole ethical foundation of medicine, informed consent, and respecting patient autonomy.
Mm. Ben, thanks ever so much. Do tell people where they can find more of your work.
Oh, if you go to www.badscience.net, you'll find everything I've ever done. 500,000 words of rambling.
Well, thank you, Ben. And people should definitely check out his book, Bad Science. It's great. I've actually got the audio book version I bought from... well, an audiobook website, surprisingly enough. It's fantastic. And that is our show for this week. Bit short, bit sweet. Liv, tell me how people can write to us if they're not me.
Oh, well, they can email us at podcast@wired.co.uk.
And they should. And we're on Twitter, @WiredUK. I am @NateLankson. And Liv, tell me what yours is.
I'm @Olivia_Solon.
There's that famous underscore everyone is talking about. And we will, of course, catch you again really soon. We'll